We're going to go back to 1 Kings chapter 19 and start at verse 13. This is all about the deep depression of the prophet Elijah after he ran away from Queen Jezebel and before he resumes his ministry in northern Israel as the great prophet in this area that has rejected the true worship of God for probably just over 75 years. Remember that Israel got started with a rejection of the proper worship at Jerusalem. So Elijah needs to get back to work despite being very depressed. He has been 40 days and 40 nights either traveling at the very beginning of it or being at Mount Sinai, Mount Horeb, down south of Judea proper, down south of the Holy Land proper. He has most recently been asked by God, "Why are you here?" And he had a very hard answer back that basically, "I'm the only one left. Nobody else is supporting you. Nobody else is worshiping you." And so God sends a display of supernatural power. We have a mighty groundbreaking wind. We have a great earthquake. We have some sort of firestorm. But the writer of this section of 1 Kings says God's not in any of those things. I mean, he controls it, but that wasn't God. It wasn't until suddenly there's this very quiet sound. Perhaps the calling of Elijah's name by the voice of God. But when that quietness happens, that's when this happens. Verse 13, when Elijah heard it, he wrapped his face in his cloak, and he went out and he stood at the entrance of the cave. And then behold, there came a voice to him and said, "What are you doing here, Elijah?" So we have that second question from God. What's going on? Tell me what's in your heart. And he does. He confesses the second time, probably with a great deal of anger and frustration. "I have been very zealous for he who is the God of hosts, for the people of Israel," that's the northern tribes, understand. The southern tribes right now, the southern kingdom of Judea is under a very godly administration. But northern Israel's got a lot of problems. So he says, "The people of northern Israel, they've forsaken your covenant. They've thrown down your altars. They've killed your prophets with the sword. I only am left, and they seek my life to take it away." So everybody's abandoned you. I'm the only one that's been on your side. And now they're trying to kill me just like they've killed other people. Now, none of that is strictly accurate. And Elijah has to know that because he's met some righteous people that have not given in to the paganism of northern Israel. And he knows that one of those guys, Obadiah, has secreted away 100 of God's prophets. He's keeping them in caves, feeding them. So this is not an accurate representation of what's happening, but it's how he feels. So God basically at this point says, "Okay, enough. You've had your 40 days. It's time for you to get back to work. And this is what you're supposed to do." Now, he gives him three specific tasks. Two of them he never gets around to. And I think it's because of his depression that he doesn't do two of these. But his follower will end up doing them. The third thing that he's told by God to do, he actually does get done. And it's very important to the story. So, verse 15, "He who has said to him, 'Go, return on your way to the wilderness of Damascus. When you arrive, you shall anoint Hazael to be king over Syria.'" So the Syrians need a new king. You're going to go and lay hands on that guy that's going to be the new king, and then we'll have a regime change, if you will. Doesn't happen under Elijah. Happens under Elisha. Then Jehu, the son of Nimshi, you shall anoint to be king over Israel. So God was ready for Ahab to pass from the scene and to have a new administration come to power. And actually, God didn't want it to be the Ahab line. And he named somebody very specific that Elijah was supposed to go and lay hands on and anoint as the new king. But Elijah never gets around to that because of his depression, seems to be the case. The one thing he does get done, though, is the third thing. And Elisha, the son of Shaphat of Abel-Meholah, you shall anoint to be prophet in your place. So Abel-Meholah is most of the way up the Jordan Valley toward the Sea of Galilee. There's kind of like a flat area, particularly on the western shore of the Jordan River Valley, there just south of the Sea of Galilee. And Abel-Meholah is in that flat land down by the river. And so that's on the path that he would have taken, Elijah would have taken if he had gone up toward Damascus, like he should have. So at least he gets this far in following God's instructions. Verse 17. And the one who escapes from the sword of Hazael shall Jehu put to death. So now we find out God was planning on using these guys as tools of judgment against sinners inside the boundaries of northern Israel. So if one of these sinners escapes from King Hazael of Syria, then King Jehu of the Israelis will put him to death. And then the one who escapes from the sword of Jehu, Elisha shall put to death, which is interesting. Prophet Elisha is going to be involved hands-on in judgment against the peoples of northern Israel. So the reason for these three new people coming into the story is to mete out God's justice against a sinful people in northern Israel. But then God finishes with this reminder that Elijah is off base when he assumes that he's the last guy standing among the true believers in the true and living God. Verse number 18, yet I will leave 7,000 in Israel, all the knees that have not bowed to Baal and every mouth that has not kissed him. So God says there are at least 7,000 who still worship me in northern Israel who have never, ever gone away from the true faith. They have definitely not bowed their knee to Baal or Asherah. They have definitely not made little images that they kiss with their mouth as they go through their little worship rituals. So Elijah, you're not alone. There's at least 7,000 like you out there. So Elijah departed from there. And then several days later, because it takes a few days to get from Mount Sinai to the south, all the way up to just south of the Sea of Galilee, he departed from there and he found Elisha, the son of Shaphat, who was plowing with 12 yoke of oxen in front of him. And he was the 12th. So they've got some sort of group agricultural project going. It seems as if this is happening in the fall, where they would have been plowing the fields, getting them ready to put seed into for their winter grain crops, winter wheat and winter barley. So Elisha is a farmhand. So he's out there guiding a plow, breaking up the ground so that he and other farmers can put seed in. But Elisha passes by him. God's pointed Elisha out to him, apparently. So he passes by him, and he cast his cloak upon him. Now, you need to take special note of this mantle. That's what we're going to call it from time to time. It's the outer garment of the way people dressed back at this time, kind of like an overcoat sort of arrangement. But it could also be used as a sleeping bag, could be used as a pillow, it could be used as a sun shield. It had a lot of uses. So in this case, though, because it is the mantle or the cloak of a prophet, it is soaking up, if you will, all of that miraculous power of the prophet, metaphorically speaking, it would appear. And so it becomes a symbol of his office as prophet to northern Israel. And so he basically takes his robe off, takes his cloak off, and kind of flings it around the shoulders of Elisha. And Elisha understands what this is. It's a signal that Elisha's been selected to become a follower of Elijah the prophet, be his helper, be his protege. And he's excited about that. He knows who this guy is. And so he left his oxen and he ran after Elijah. So we get the picture now that Elijah basically just flung his little mantle around the shoulders of Elisha and just kept on walking. And so Elisha has to stop his oxen, and he has to kind of get disentangled from however he's hooked up to the plow to make sure that it works properly. And he runs to follow after Elijah, and then he makes a request. He says, "Let me kiss my father and my mother goodbye," basically is what he's saying, "and then I'll follow you. So let me wrap up things with my family, and I'll be right behind you." And so Elijah said back to him, "Go back again. What have I done to you?" Which I equate with our more modern dismissal of things that we don't really care about. We say, "Whatever. Whatever. Yeah, go. Whatever." Because I hate to acknowledge it because it frustrates me. Elijah is still in that deep blue funk. Despite the intervention of God, this guy is still horribly depressed. And so he's going through the motions of selecting this new servant, this protege of his. And he's not even going to bother to go to Syria. He's not going to bother to go and tell Jehu that he's the new king. He's going to leave those two things for later, for Elisha to take care of. Verse 21, so he, meaning Elisha, left the oxen, returned from following him and took the yoke of oxen. So he runs back to his pair of oxen, two oxen in this yoke. He took the yoke of oxen and sacrificed them and boiled their flesh with the yokes of the oxen and gave it to the people, and they ate. So he basically stops his part in the plowing party. He sacrifices his two animals. He breaks up his wooden plow and turns that into the sacrificial wood, throws the oxen on there, cut up for the purposes of burning up some of it, but also cooking some of it, because it's not a sin sacrifice. It's a free will offering, and therefore the majority of the meat belongs to the sacrificer, who is, in this case, Elisha. But he's doing it because he wants to thank God for becoming a follower now, a protege of Prophet Elijah, but he also wants to say goodbye to all his neighbors and friends because he's traveling now. He understands that's what's about to happen. So he has his going away party, basically, and then he arose and he went after Eliyahu and assisted him. He went after Elijah and became his protege, his servant. Remember, Elijah had left his last attendant at Beersheba, just kind of fired him, let him go, because evidently he didn't think he was going to be needing him much longer since he was planning on dying. But now he needs a new person, and God's already picked him out. At this point, I want to make an advance apology, because I know I do this every single time we come to these stories. I will mix, screw up the names Elijah and Elisha, and I want to ask in advance for your understanding and forgiveness for that. It is just one of those things where I flip them around without realizing that I've done it. And so you just correct it in your own mind whenever it happens, please. Keep in mind that Eliyahu's name, Elijah's name, means Yah is my God. Elisha's name, as you can tell from the spelling, is close to that. It just has a different verb involved. His name means, my God helps. My God is generous or victorious or very helpful. And so both names help the Israeli people understand the importance of these guys' ministries. And they become very important prophets during this period in history. Okay, verse number 1 of chapter number 20 is where we're going to go to next. And I'm going to throw a date, at least a year, on this one. I believe this is taking place in 866 BC. I think Ahab has been the king of northern Israel for about 19 years. The northern country of Israel has existed for just over 75 years, about 76 years. And at the very beginning of northern Israel's history, there was some fighting going on down to the south between northern Israel and southern Judah, arguments about the borderland. And the king of Judah at that time, Asa, reached out to the king of Syria, or the king of Damascus, to help him in this little border skirmish. Now, he shouldn't have done it, and he got in trouble over it. But what he'd asked was that the king of Syria, the king of Damascus, would break a treaty that he had with the king of Israel and punish him, cause trouble. And so the king of Syria, because he was bribed with a bunch of silver, he did exactly that. And he invaded northern Israel, took over the northern Jordan River Valley, right down to the area around the Sea of Galilee. So all of that has been in Syria's hands for several decades. What happens next is an attempt by the king of Syria, the king of Damascus, to take over even more territory. So chapter 20, verse 1. Ben-Hadad. Hadad is the name of a god figure up in the north. And so he has a name or a title saying that he's the son of the Syrian god, Hadad. So Ben-Hadad, the king of Syria, gathered all his army together. 32 kings were with him. These are under kings. These are regional leaders. With horses and chariots. And so he went up and he closed in on Samaria and fought against it. So King Ben-Hadad takes a big military force and begins to besiege the capital city of Samaria. He sent messengers into the city to Ahab, king of Israel, and said to him, "Thus says Ben-Hadad, your silver and your gold are mine. Your best wives and children are also mine." So basically, I want all your stuff. I'll leave you alone if you give me your stuff and be under my boot, be under my control. So this is a hostile takeover attempt by the Syrians over the northern kingdom of Israel. So the king of Israel was basically willing to go along with this. He was ready to become a vassal of Ben-Hadad. So the king of Israel, Ahab, said, "As you say, my lord, O king, I am yours and all that I have." So, yes, sir, I will send family hostages to you. I'll send you silver and gold. Verse number 5, the messengers came again and said, "Thus says Ben-Hadad, I sent to you, saying, deliver to me your silver and your gold, your wives and your children. Nevertheless, I will send my servants to you tomorrow about this time, and they shall search your house and the houses of your servants and lay hands on whatever pleases you and take it away." So Ben-Hadad, he doesn't care that the guy just promised to pay him tribute money. He says, "Nah, you know what? What's going to happen is, I'm going to send my people and you're going to let them just look through your palace, look through your personal residences, your properties, and take whatever they want. That's what you have to do if you want to agree to be my vassal." The king of Israel called all the elders of the land. So he calls a big emergency council meeting. And he said, "Mark now, see how this man is seeking trouble. For he sent to me for my wives and my children and for my silver and my gold, and I did not refuse him." So he expresses to us what's really going on here. He says, "Men of the council, I was told I had to give up money and hostages to the king of Damascus, and I agreed to do that. But now he wants to come and take whatever he feels like." And so all the elders, all the people said to Ahab, "Don't listen or consent. No, don't do it. He's going to break us as a people. We ought to resist." So Ahab said to the messengers of Ben-Hadad, "Tell my lord the king, all that you first demanded of your servant, I will do." So if you're still wanting tribute money, silver and gold, and hostages from my own family, I'll still do that. I'll comply if that's what you're willing to take. But this secondary thing, this idea that you can come in and take whatever you want, no, I can't agree to that. I can't allow that. So Ben-Hadad sent to him, the messengers depart and give him this word from Ahab. And Ben-Hadad sent to him and said, "The gods," by which he means Hadad and Baal and Asherah, "the gods do so to me and more also, if the dust of Samaria shall suffice for handfuls for the people who follow me." Now what he's referencing here is the idea, we are going to obliterate your city so badly that the people traveling with me won't be able to find much to take with them home. They'll be lucky to have a couple of handfuls of dust from what used to be Samaria. So he is just threatening him with total annihilation. So the king of Israel answered, and finally Ahab gets some spine. He finally gets some intestinal fortitude. And so he tells this last batch of messengers from Ben-Hadad, you tell him, let not him who straps on his armor boast himself as if as one who takes it off. So it's basically the idea of, you think you're tough as you're getting ready for the fight. We'll see how tough you are after the fight is done. Don't be trying to count your chickens before they hatch. Verse 12, when Ben-Hadad heard this message as he was drinking with the kings in the booths, so he's got a siege camp set up, and he's partying, he then said to his men, take your positions. And they took their positions against the city. So it's time to attack and take this guy out. We've only got about a minute left, so we can just only set up the stage here. God has made a few inroads into northern Israel so that he can make overtures to King Ahab and all the other Israelis to come back to the true worship of him, the creator God of the universe, to give up on all the paganism of the past and embrace the true and living God as their commander in chief. And so there is more and more calls for repentance, more and more calls for revival going on in northern Israel. And so it is at this point that God sends an unnamed prophet to invite Ahab to trust God to deal with Ben-Hadad. So mark your place at 1 Kings 20, verse 13, and that's where we'll next get back into the Word.